This episode is brought to you by Set for Life Insurance. Listen, docs, one of the first steps we took to pay off our student loan debt was realizing we paid way too much for our disability insurance. That all changed when we found Set for Life Insurance. They helped us with a customized insurance policy that met our needs and, most of all, budget. To learn more, check out setforlifeinsurance.com. Hey, you. Yeah, you, the one listening to this podcast right now. I'm guessing you tune into Docs Outside the Box because taking control of your career is really important to you. Now, our sponsor, Provider Solutions and Development, they have a team of experts that are ready to guide docs just like you through today's job landscape. They've also got exclusive access to hundreds of positions nationwide. So whether you're looking to dive deeper into your specialty work or, let's keep it real, you're trying to find a healthier work-life balance, it's important to start the conversation with them right now. Contact them at info.psdconnect.org/docs outside the box. All right, everyone. I got Travis Hornsby. He is the founder of Student Loan Planner. You've helped so many people. You've counseled so many people with millions and close to what? Are we getting close to $379 million saved on student loans with your student loan planner? So you've been helping a lot of people out. And there's a lot of things that are going over the news. There's inflation, there's recession, possibly. Let's talk. What kind of information are you giving people who have student loan debt, particularly people who have high income earners, have a ton of student loan debt? They hear all this news with going on with increasing, you know, inflation, recession. What kind of advice are you giving out?
Well, first, Nate, can I ask, when did you graduate from medical school?
I graduated from medical school in 2006, so I'm a dinosaur now.
Okay, so like the people that you went to medical school need to get their like need to listen like most closely to this.
Right.
So a lot of the people that went to med school in the 2000s like didn't have the right kind of loans. You know, you borrowed maybe under the FFEL loan program, FFEL loan program.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different kinds of programs that you can borrow from, right? In 2010, after the financial crisis, the government took over the student loan system completely. So then everybody after 2010 had something called a direct loan, and people before 2010 had something called an FFEL loan for funding their med school, right? And the people that were graduates from before 2010 couldn't get access to something called public service loan forgiveness. So that's a program that a lot of physicians can use that work at nonprofit or government hospitals to get a lot of their loans forgiven, right? So what's like really nuts going on right now is we just want people to be aware that there's this thing called the public service loan forgiveness waiver. So for example, like say you had some friends that you went to med school with that graduated in 2006. Maybe they have a 2% interest rate on their student loans, and they've just kept it federal for us, you know, this whole time because they got such a low interest rate.
Yeah, that was the days when you can consolidate at such a low rate.
Right. So if you consolidate again, if you happen to be working at a nonprofit hospital or a government hospital, and then you apply for public service loan forgiveness, the entire balance that you owe would be eligible for forgiveness completely.
Really? Now, if you applied for that, do you still have to go through the many years of consecutive payments, or does it take into account what you've done before?
So that's why I wanted to start off the show talking about this, because this shows you kind of how crazy this stuff is,
okay.
Right?
All right?
So usually the answer is you'd restart your whole set of 10 years of payments. And if you're making a really good income as a mid-career physician, you know that's not going to make sense, right? You're not going to be able to pay a percent of your income to get a low enough payment to get anything forgiven. But during this PSLF waiver, which is technically due to the pandemic, national health emergency still not being over, they have until October 31st of this year, they're waiving all the requirements, which means that all the previous service that you had under the old loan system can count towards the 10 years that you need. So if you did your residency or your fellowship, at a nonprofit hospital, which most people do, obviously, and then if you worked for a few extra years at a nonprofit or academic hospital, so you could count all that credit towards those 10 years that you need. So I'm running into tons of 40-something-year-old physicians right now that normally are not eligible for forgiveness, that are not only eligible for forgiveness, but they can take two steps, which is consolidate and apply for it, and then the entire thing is totally forgiven, tax-free immediately.
See, that's what I'm talking about. That's how you start a show. You see what I'm saying, Travis? So you got the listeners hooked in. You got them know. Because, I mean, I think a lot of people, particularly, like you said, folks like me, folks who are, you know, they graduated before 2010, like we are knee-deep, either already done with our student loans, getting ready to handle our student loans in a fashion. But either way, we kind of feel like we're not eligible for PSLF. It doesn't matter. There's no help for us. Nothing is going to get done. So that's the silver lining, folks, is so where do they find out this information about the waiver?
Well, you can type in PSLF waiver online and you'll see stuff up about it. So PSLF, that's the loan program, right? And then waiver. So type that into Google. One of our guides will probably be on page one, but the top result is going to be the student aid website. And that's where you can go to, you know, kind of verify that what I'm telling you is true. And what you've got to do is consolidate all of your loans, especially if you've already have the number of 120 months worth of credit, you know, you've got to consolidate your loans at studentaid.gov. So that's step one. And step two is to apply for it at studentaid.gov/PSLF. Now, the crazy thing about this program is it's not just for people who can get the whole thing forgiven immediately. Some people might have what I call them unicorn loans.
Okay.
So think about if you have one loan from undergrad or a couple loans from undergrad, and maybe you worked as a teacher for a few years before going to medical school, or maybe you did, you know, some work as, you know, as just an employee, you know, at a nonprofit hospital just for the experience before going to medical school. So that credit can count towards this PSLF waiver program too.
When you say credit, you mean that year of working counts as credit?
So let's say, here's an example, right? So let's say you were a teacher from 2007 to 2010, and then you went to medical school from 2010 to 2014, and then you graduated, you know, medical school, and then you started your residency in 2014, right? So, you know, you might have 2014 to 2022 credit at nonprofit hospitals. So that's 8 years worth of credit. So since you went to, you were a teacher before going to medical school and you made some payments on your loans from undergrad, you could now consolidate those old loans with the medical school loans all together, and you can get that extra credit from before medical school applied to your medical school loans, even though it was before, you know, you borrowed for that.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, let's say that you did that same thing, but let's say you were a teacher from, you know, 2010 to 2013, and you went to med school between 2013 and 2017. Well, you don't have 10 total years worth of credit yet, because you're not at the 10 years worth of PSLF credit that you've got to have. So 2017 to 2022 is 5 years. You know, the 3 years before medical school, that's 8 years. But think about this. You can still consolidate and get all that credit from when you were a teacher added to the total if you consolidate and apply for it in time. So that shaves off 3 years of credit on your medical school loans, which, by the way, you know, if you're paying, you know, as an attending, that could be $2,000 or $3,000 a month. So effectively, by doing that one simple thing, you know, you're saving $2,000 or $3,000 a month for 3 years. And so there's like all these hacks right now that the normal rules don't apply, and it's only until October 31st.
As you're talking, I'm like looking this up right now, because I'm like, this is going to definitely be in the show notes. Keep going. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, I mean, so a lot of people think that, okay, I can only do this if I'm eligible for complete forgiveness.
Right.
And it's not actually true. You can still get extra credit towards the 10 years. You know, you can get, you know, if your loans have different numbers of credit, you can get the one with the maximum amount of credit applied to it. So it's really if you're in the wrong repayment plan, you can get all that credit counted. And here's another crazy thing. If you were in deferment or forbearance during residency, you can now even get that credit applied to your public service loan forgiveness, provided that it was at least for 12 months or in aggregate 36 months. So there's all these kind of very unique rules that, again, normally don't apply. And physicians, you know, like my wife, for example, is the physician. She doesn't pay attention to loan rules. She doesn't.
No, we ain't got time for all that, man.
Yeah,
and a lot of this stuff is like reading legalese almost. You're like, well, wait, what? What do I qualify? You're not sure. What? Even with you saying all the different numbers and the consecutive this, that could be a little bit confusing. But the most important thing is that there's going to be links, guys, in the show notes where you all can listen and read up on this and see what you're saying. But yeah, I mean, you make a good point. Your wife is a physician. She had a ton of student loan debt. As a matter of fact, that's like the genesis of student loan planner. Like, you helped her get out of all this debt, right? But go ahead, please. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so and the thing is this is really, I would say anybody that's working at a nonprofit or government hospital. So, you know, you know, pick any hospital in the country, it's probably a nonprofit 501c3. And, you know, the VA counts, community health, you know, hospitals count, all that stuff. Now, what if you don't work at one of those places? What if you're a physician or somebody that doesn't work at one of those qualifying employers?
Right.
Or what if you
private practice
part-time? Yeah. Or private practice, yeah. So there's still stuff available for you too. Mm-hmm. So there's, in addition to the PSLF waiver, there's an income-based repayment waiver as well. And so those same, you know, things that apply to public service loan forgiveness can also apply to the income-based repayment stuff. So a lot of people like that might be in private practice might be able to get a bunch of extra credit towards their forgiveness as well. Maybe get forgiveness instead of after 10 years, maybe after 20 years. And that program doesn't require any employment like restrictions. You can be part-time, you can be at private practice. And then other people are going to say, well, I still can't get any help. All I owe is $100,000. I make $300,000 a year. You know, I work in private practice. Like, what help is there for me? Well, you know, there's still stuff that you can think about. Like, when do you refinance if you should refinance? You know, is there going to be another extension of the student loan pause? If so, what's that going to look like? What should be your strategy for, you know, trying to get your interest rate low with this rising interest rate environment, right? So I would say probably almost anybody that owes over $100,000 right now could get a really large amount of savings and possibly the whole thing forgiven.
Here's a tip when looking for your next job. Understand your strengths and weaknesses. For example, if you've been practicing for a while and you know you have a problem with closing charts, then it's important that you find a place that's going to help you have administrative help, right? So there are plenty of options when it comes to your career in medicine. But just like every patient is different, every physician has their own personal definition of success. And that's where our sponsor steps in. Provider Solutions and Development doesn't bring just one answer for all. They are recruitment experts focusing on who you are before helping you find what you're meant to be. So whatever you're ready for next, they'll help you find it with no quotas, no commissions to get in the way. So even if you're looking for a more collegial feel at work or just, heck, a more healthier work-life balance, they can help find the right fit for you. So reach out today at info.psdconnect.org/docs-outside-the-box. So in this environment right now, where you have high income earner, whether they are medical student, whether they are a physician, whether maybe a physician assistant, a nurse or what have you. Let's say, for example, they come to you and they say, well, I have over $200,000 of debt or $300,000 of debt. Is there any circumstance where you would say, hey, it's okay to go ahead and just pay it all off if you're going to do it in like 3 years, 5 years? Do you ever recommend doing that?
I mean, sure. Yeah, I think paying off debt's great, but it just got to be in the context of your other goals, right? So if I said, I don't know, I mean, you could pick some sort of really valuable health procedure you could do for somebody, but if there's something worse that's bothering them, that's going to be priority, right? So it's kind of like that for physicians. You know, if maybe you want to buy a house, maybe you want to start your own practice, maybe you want to take that trip to Europe that we've been waiting on two plus years, you know, into the pandemic, right? So I would say that it's just got to be contextual. It's got to be based off of what are your dreams, what are your goals, and then if you do make a lot of money, you want to get rid of your debt in 3 years. I think that's great. But, you know, you just want to make it in the context of an overall plan. I can give like more details if we had like a hypothetical.
Yeah. So, because I think what you just mentioned before with the waiver, the next question I was going to ask when we first started was, is there any silver linings with what's going on? But that was actually in context of, you know, inflation rates going up, you know, possible recession. This sounds like this waiver is from based off of coronavirus or what's been going on with the pandemic. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, like you know how people can still do telehealth,
right?
You know, because you know those are temporary waivers that exist from the National Emergency Declaration, and so based off of that same declaration, they're using that authority to do all this student loan stuff right now. So that's why the interest is still paused without an act of Congress. You know, that's why the forgiveness programs are just a lot looser right now. And we even expect there to be a new income-based repayment program for physicians coming out probably. In late summer, we think that there might be another IBR plan that might be even more generous than the current options that exist.
Okay, so real quick, quickly let us know, what is the difference between PSLF and IBR? Talk to us about that.
So IBR is a payment plan. P- PSLF is a loan forgiveness strategy.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a checking account and a savings account, mm-hmm. You know, but both of them are considered cash. I don't know. It's not a great analogy.
No,
but,
I get it.
You know, yeah, basically you sign up for an IBR plan or any other plan, and then you can use that plan for multiple different strategies. So you could pay more than you owe. That would be something that you'd be paying down your loans, right? So if you're in residency, you sign up for revised pay as you earn. That's one of the plans that gives you interest subsidies. You could pay extra and then, you know, pay down some of your interest or pay down some of your principal, right? So that's – you're on the repayment plan of whatever it is, which is your income-based plan, and then you can do other things. So like you could pay as little as possible and go for forgiveness, or you could pay extra because you think you're going to be paying it down in full, right? So PSLF is just a strategy where if you're on a certain kind of plan for 10 years, at the end of those 10 years, the balance is forgiven if you were making payments the whole time and an employer that qualifies.
Now I get it. Okay, gotcha. Did you see the NPR report that came out, like an exclusive back in April or March, where it was talking about a lot of these servicers, they weren't even keeping track, or they're not keeping track of how many payments, what the credits are that were going towards you know, PSLF or even just forgiveness in general. What'd you think about that?
I mean, you know, doing internet stuff full time, right? You kind of realize that like the incentive structures for media is like to get clicks, get views, like create controversy. You know, even for an institution like NPR, which is, you know, supposed to not be as susceptible to that as, you know, like BuzzFeed or you know,
Deadspin,
you know, one of those kind of places. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so the reason why it's, I think, a little misleading is the loan servicers never received guidance from Department of Ed to track anything. Like they have to receive instructions from the Department of Education to track payments for them to do that. Now, for public service loan forgiveness, that's been in place since 2012. And the reason is because that's a 10-year program where a whole lot of people are becoming eligible in the 2020s. But if you look at income-based repayment, virtually nobody is eligible for forgiveness under the 20-year plan until the 2030s. So one of the reasons they've never built the payment tracker yet is because nobody's eligible until about 10 years from now. Right now, people in that report stated, "Oh, there's people on this income contingent repayment plan that, you know, or their payment counts are not being tracked." That might be true, but it affects a few dozen people in the whole country. So they created an income based plan in the 90s, but the way they created it meant that almost nobody was eligible for low payments. So they required you to pay 20% of your income. You can only borrow a very low amount of loans. So mathematically, you know, it's almost impossible to get anything forgiven unless you're disabled. But if you're disabled, the loans are forgiven anyway, right? So in other words, you had to have like an undergrad-sized loan and make below the poverty line and not be disabled for like 25 years. Well, that just doesn't apply to hardly any people. So it was one of those things where, is it a problem? Sure. But it's just because they hadn't made the payment tracker yet, and they hadn't made the payment tracker yet for the 20-year and 25-year forgiveness because they hadn't received that instruction from the Department of Education on how to do it. And the contractors are not going to take proactive action on a government program unless the policymakers tell them what they should be doing.
Okay, so now that adds a little bit of context to what we're talking about. You know, the thing that I was interested in that report was the counseling folks to go into forbearance instead of using other types of repayment plans. And I remember, like, you know, obviously I don't count in that group because I was going to through residency in 2006 to 2011, but I just remember having a hard time paying my student loans, at least the monthly payments, not in deferment anymore. And the next step was forbearance. And my loans had ballooned from by the time I finished undergrad, or by the time I finished medical school to when I graduated from residency, from $240,000 to $330,000, right? It was crazy. Same thing happened to my wife also. Is that a common, I'm sure you, when you work with a lot of people, do you see that a lot or?
Yeah, it's forbearance steering. And that's something that, you know, they entered into a settlement with the Department of Education for doing that.
I'm getting, you know, my $500 in the mail soon. Go figure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's that settlement. Yeah, 230, I think it is. It's sort of like, oh, great, thanks.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the issue with the forbearance stuff is it's just sort of like companies responding to incentives. They have a low bid contract. Their goal is to keep costs low. And, you know, people call up that can't pay. instruct them on how to apply for income-driven repayment, instruct them how to recalculate their payment, that's probably a 15-minute conversation. And the forbearance conversation is like a 30-second conversation, right? Where you just say, stop my payments, turn it off, you know, let's go, right? And so I think companies had a
That's exactly how it happened for me. It was just, I would be in between cases. And I even memorized the phone number that I was ducking. And I would see it and it'd be in between cases. And like, what do I need to do to get you to stop calling me? 30-second conversation. Yeah. And then they make you listen to some recording. And then you say yes. And then that's it. You're done.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that's that's what happened. That's one of the reasons they're doing this waiver right now is to try to correct some of those problems. The real problem I've got with these waivers is they made them in such a way where, like, you have to know a lot of stuff to get them in a lot of cases.
You're talking about waivers like this one that you just mentioned before.
The ones right – yeah, the ones happening right now, right? Like, so what's happening is the people getting forgiveness, from what we can tell, are higher debt, more highly educated, higher income, which makes sense because you have to, like, have – you know, the understanding to navigate the rules, or you have to have resources to hire people who can do it for you, right? And so that's kind of like, I would say, like maybe aggravating the problem even more within the student loan portfolio where people like that have that high level of education are getting, you know, the sort of the rules and fixes applied to their accounts faster and quicker. And in some cases, they're happening for those people that it will not happen for others because you got to take action before this emergency declaration expires, which it almost certainly will by the end of the year if, you know, the Democrats lose one of the houses of Congress, right? So so I think that, yeah, so it's like reading that report, it makes a lot of sense, like that there's problems that, sure. The only thing I would say too is you also have to think about what's the context. Like why is this report coming out? I think it's really interesting. So like both sides kind of use it for their own advantage,
right?
Like, so Republicans like point out and they're saying, hey, look, this is evidence why the government shouldn't be involved in student loans, right? And then like the Democratic side is sort of saying, hey, look, the student loans are totally broken. The system's totally broken. That's why we need to cancel all of it, or that's why we need to do this big thing. And actually what's funny is there was a CBS 60 Minutes report on how PSLF was broken. And then right immediately after that report came out, the PSLF waiver announcement happened. And for this NPR report, this huge report came out about how broken IBR is. And then like literally 2 days later, there was this big announcement of the IBR waiver. So what's clearly happening is somebody in the administration is leaking, you know, things to the press to create sort of this big, like, look how broken this is. And then so they can have that sort of,
the backing,
you know,
public
reason.
Backing.
The public backing and just the impetus and the media to say, oh, this is why we have to go do this thing, right? So I would be paying attention to any kind of blockbuster reports that come out because probably what happens a couple days later is some big announcement about your loans.
Gotcha.
If you see something like that.
So listen, I'm really interested because I get some feedback on Instagram. So there's been particularly one student who's written to me, but I don't think that this person writing to me is out of the ordinary. So they are struggling with the decision to go to PA school because they're concerned with two things. One, the amount of student loan debt, or excuse me, the amount of PA student loan debt they're going to graduate with, and then also the salary that they're going to be making afterwards. The salary increase is not commensurate with the student loan increase also. So he's concerned, well, if I go to PA school and I graduate with maybe over $200,000 of debt, am I destroying my life? Am I putting myself on the road to ruin by taking this path? So me and Renee, you know, we discussed, you know, the whole process of how we paid off our debt and how you can do it, live within your means, and all these different repayment options that I went to your website and I found that article. I'll put it in the show notes. It's a really good article, guys, in there for what physician assistant students can do. But, you know, I think it's really concerning, though, that I don't think he's alone, where a lot of students, whatever profession they're going into, I think mainly the professions that are going to be the quote-unquote high-ticket items, PA school, you know, medical school, a lot of people are concerned that should they get into that, and is like the juice worth the squeeze, you know, so to speak, or whatever it is. Is the squeeze worth the drink? Whatever it, you know what I'm talking about. Is it worth it to graduate from school and have all the student loan debt? I'm sure you're getting a lot of phone calls when you talk to people and they're just like, man, did I even make the right decision, when they're looking for counseling from you?
Well, we do actually have a pre-debt consult. It's not super booked compared to the after debt consult, because that's when people's pain actually happens.
It's like premarital, you know, and postmarital counseling.
Exactly. Like, yeah, exactly. Like a premarital counseling might be like, what, one meeting, and not, you know, everybody goes through it, right? But then the postmarital stuff, you spend thousands of dollars, meet for years, you know. I mean, so that, it's kind of like that. So basically, like for PA school, I think that the framing of the question is probably not the best. So the way I would encourage that person to think about debt is, we've got a really warped student loan system in the U.S. where the schools have no incentive to be frugal, because you can pay back your loans as a percent of your income. So that means for grad school, they can charge you as much as they want, and you will always just pay a percent of your income. Well, that's like an income tax.
Right.
And if you borrow an absolute massive amount, that payment is exactly the same if you go to a private school in downtown Los Angeles or if you go to a frugal school in the middle of Iowa, right? So after you borrow more than your debt, like if he's projecting he's going to borrow more than his income and student loan debt to go to this school,
definitely,
then the cost doesn't matter. It's really like an income tax. So then if you think about income taxes, are you better off making more money or less money? You're better off making more money, right? Mm-hmm. So we would look at that.
Depends on who you ask. Well, excuse me. Depends on which machine you listen to, right?
Well,
yeah, which propaganda machine you listen to. But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, but like, you know, I'm saying, you know, in general, like if you could say, okay, you could be, you know, what's the word for it? Like a med tech or assistant or something like that, you know, making 30,000 or 40,000 a year. Or, I mean, you could even look at it as simply like, would you want to go to get your college degree and be an RN versus being a PA?
Correct.
I mean, you know, let's say the average, you know, nurse is making, you know, 60,000-70,000 and the average PA is making, you know, 80,000 to 120,000. Well, if you're losing like about 10% of your income as a PA making 120,000, that net is, you know, 108,000. That's still better than what you would earn as a nurse.
Correct.
Right? So from a financial perspective, I think that that person just has to realize that it's student debts and income tax. So really, are you going to get a degree that's valuable? Is that degree going to pay you more than what you'd earn as a bachelor's degree holder, at least 10% more? If the answer is yes, then you should go to PA school and not stress about the loans.
Okay. So it all comes down to mathematics and how you look at, you know, what's the trade-offs. I like that answer. That's a really interesting answer. But I will put that link to your article where you talk specifically about the repayment options for PAs, physician assistants, in there. So I think a lot of medical students are starting to feel that also. I've seen a lot of tweets where medical students are getting towards the end of their education. They're doing their exit interviews and they're realizing how much student loan debt they have. And they start to realize, oh man, my 21-year-old self was making decisions that maybe my 25-year-old or 27-year-old self wasn't really ready to check or cash. So I think it's really interesting as we get to that point. That's why I asked that question also. So, all right. So let's talk about, I'm really interested in this example that you have on your website. So you have a pharmacist who's making $2,000 monthly on his loans while he's working at a community hospital. After working with you, right, after counseling with you, you guys were able to cut his monthly student loan payment to $600 and then maximize $200,000 in loan forgiveness that he was eligible for. So explain how that works with this pharmacist. I'm sure a lot of other people who are listening, they can extrapolate this into their own experience also.
The funny thing is I would classify that as like an easy example of something that people could mess up, because it's not super complicated. He was just signing up for the standard plan. So they send him a bill. If you don't apply for income base, they just tell you, here's your bill. It's the standard plan. Pay 10% of your, you know, or 1% of your loan amount monthly is approximately the amount that they tell you to pay. So he had $200,000. That means they sent him a bill for $2,000 a month. And so he was paying that. He made, I think, about $100,000 a year working as a pharmacist at a community hospital. So it was simple for him as saying, hey, pay as you earn is 10% of your income with a big deduction based off your family size. So that just worked out to about $600 a month, because he made $100,000 a year, got a big deduction before they take 10% of his income. Then you divide by 12 to get a monthly payment, and that monthly payment worked out to about $600 a month. So if you just extrapolate that payment for 10 years, you know, the difference between that cost and him paying it back in full with the standard 10-year plan, you know, ended up being about, you know, 150 to 200 something thousand.
Oh no, you're gonna have to re-explain that again. Let's do this again. Hold on.
Yep.
So the standard plan would have been 1% of his student loan, of his total amount, and that's over 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's about, 10-year amortization is the technical term for it. So 200,000, you pay 2,000 a month.
Okay.
With the interest cost thrown in there, that means your loan's done in about 10 years.
Okay. And then versus what he applied for, which was?
Pay as you earn, one of the income-based plans.
Okay. Explain that one.
Yeah. So you pay, 10% of your income, right?
Okay. 10% of your income. So
what people should know is it's 10% of your AGI, not just your income. Right. So if you save for retirement, if you have like dependent care FSA because you've got kids in daycare, they take some things off the top and then you pay 10% of that number. But they also give you 150% of the poverty line as a deduction before you pay 10%. So it's kind of like the standard deduction for taxes. You get like 12,000 that you don't pay any taxes on, and then it's, the money above that number is similar for student loans. So for his number, if he's got 100,000 of income, they give him about a $20,000 deduction before they take 10%. So he's going to get charged, 10% of, that difference between 100,000 and his deduction of about 20. So he gets 10% of 80,000, times 10%, that's 8,000, divide by 12, that's about, 700 a month. But, he also saved for retirement and did some things like that, which is what was getting him down to 600 a month.
And then how long is his payment? How long will he be paying for?
Well, he paid for 3 years already on the standard plan, mm-hmm. So those 3 years counted for him. So he had 7 more years to go.
So 10 years in this new plan, in this new payment plan that he applied to, qualified for, and that you're describing.
Right. So about 7,000 a year. You can say he had to pay 7,000 a year for about 7 more years. That's about 49,000. Versus if he paid back his 200 something thousand of loans, if adding in all the interest costs, it would have been, about 250,000 of principal plus interest. So he's saving, 200,000 just, and that's a situation where most people would be aware of that. Like most people would be aware that they could do public service loan forgiveness. That was several years ago where the awareness of this program wasn't very high. So people would make these mistakes all the time. I would say that mistake is a lot less common now, but there's a lot of not common or not easy mistakes that people make that, also cost them that much
money. Let's get into that. Let's bust into that. Come on, let's go. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. You're on a roll.
If you're married, if you don't sign up for the right repayment program, you got to include your spouse in your loans. You got to pay a percent of your spouse's income too, and not just your income.
Say that again.
So if you're married and you have loans, maybe your spouse doesn't, or maybe they have loans. If you sign up for the wrong repayment plan or you file your taxes the wrong way, you're going to include their income in your payment. Now that's something that people haven't felt the pain of for 2.5 years because payments have been paused with the pandemic. But when they start up again, that's going to be a big problem for people, is that they're going to have their spouse making money and then they don't want to include their spouse. But then, the payments, you've got to include them if you don't do it the right way. If you file a certain way for taxes and you sign up for a certain repayment plan, you can exclude your spouse from your loan payments because income-based, right? Is it income-based on yours or is it income-based as a couple? So knowing that's a really big deal, you got to make that decision the right way.
And a lot of people spend a lot of time during the pandemic. There was time off and it may have caused a lot of mm-hmm. divorces. So what happens when you divorce and you're in that situation? Who gets the loan? Does that split up? As soon as you get a divorce, that's it? The loan goes back to whoever it belongs to, or is it split among both?
It depends.
What?
It depends. So generally speaking, the debt stays with the person that borrowed it.
Okay.
But in some cases, there's parent plus loans, and the parent plus loans might have been borrowed for a kid. And so I've seen divorce decrees where the parent plus loan, the judge will rule that it has to be split a certain proportion between two parents. But this is it'd be kind of funny if it wasn't sad. The person that had that loan in a lot of cases could go for forgiveness, but when they have a divorce decree requiring a split of the loan, it cannot be done through the federal system. So what they do is they force the two people to refinance it, and they take a loan that's forgivable and turn it into a private loan that's not forgivable. So in effect, like a lot of these divorce decrees are treating student loans with this like Susie Orman, Dave Ramsey, debt is bad like mentality, but this is a different kind of loan. This is not a credit card. This is not a car loan. This is totally different, and the debts are ballooned like this because of the income-based payment programs that don't have any incentive to keep costs low.
So there's a bunch of a bunch of protections that are baked into it that now you are just taking out of it when
taking
you-
away. Yeah. So I've had a case where I had to tell a couple that was divorcing, literally, you need to talk to your lawyers, take this back to the judge because it's in both of your interests to actually keep the loan in the one person's name that has it and then come up with like an alimony or like a lump sum cash payment to the other spouse that had the loans instead of refinancing it. Because, you know, in other words, like the spouse that was going to take 30% of it, she would have had to pay back $150K, but she was only going to have to pay like $20,000 over 20 years based off of her projected income. So it can get super complicated super quick. You know, I'd say to people, if you've got, you know, more than $100,000 of student loans, you know, you're kind of like somebody that's got, you know, they have got their TurboTax and everybody tells them, oh, just do your TurboTax, right. You know, but you've got your 1099, you've right. got your write-offs, you've got your mileage deduction, you've got all these things going on, and you're probably going to hurt yourself more than you're going to help yourself
by doing TurboTax.
By trying to navigate it, yeah, by yourself. You certainly can. Some people do have straightforward situations. If you're single the whole time, if you're working at the same nonprofit employer the whole time, yeah, maybe you just sign up for an income-based plan and just apply for PSLF every year. You don't need any help.
So,
you know, max out your retirement plans, et cetera. But most people have actual things that happen in their life that make that not easy.
So I mentioned that pharmacist. You said that was an easy situation. You have far more worse. Like, what's the worst situation you've seen?
Like,
that you could remember.
There's something called the spousal consolidation loan. In the mid-2000s,
what
you could consolidate your loans together.
Okay.
So you could take a husband and wife and consolidate the loans jointly. But then they didn't make an allowance for what happens when you get divorced.
Okay.
And so what would happen is folks would get married and they would combine their loans and they would get divorced. In some cases, due to, you know, really tragic things like domestic violence, and you've got like an abused ex-spouse that now has to contact their abuser and ask for their income information so they can pay joint income-based payments on a loan that's, you know, from – when they got divorced 10 years ago. So
is that loan still in existence or is that gone?
There's something that's in the works.
Okay.
They're passing a bill right now to try to help these people. There's only 600 people that have this kind of loan, okay. But I figure we probably talked to probably 20% of them personally, you know, because a lot of these people are desperate for help and they reach out everywhere to try to get help. That's like one kind of extreme bad type of loan. But I've seen situations where, you know, people were told to refinance and they were eligible for forgiveness and didn't even realize it. I've seen a couple that had $1.9 million of debt as a couple that just, you know, actually was just making all the wrong choices on that loan. I've seen people who were in default that could have made – they were having their wages garnished at 15% when they could actually pay their loan and pay 10%. So think about that. They're having their finances ruined, their credit ruined. And they're having 15% of their wages garnished where if they only knew to apply for a particular payment plan, they could only have to pay 10% and not have any of those bad things happen to them.
How did you get all this knowledge? Like you literally were just helping your wife out and then all of a sudden you just went down this like mecca, this journey and then came back like
extreme rabbit hole.
Yeah, like how did you get all this information?
I think it was out of necessity, right? So I used to be a bond trader, didn't like that as much as I liked helping people like figuring out financial problems personally in their own lives, right? So I kind of found this because of my wife trying to figure out her loans together as a couple.
Did you have debt yourself or?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I mean, it was like a wake-up call, you know, kind of because I just, you know, went to undergrad, went to a state school, you know, had some scholarships, so I didn't have to worry about that.
Gotcha.
Like a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, her debt was so complicated. I initially was just helping out her friends and she was like, you know, you should really just do this. This is like a big problem. So I started it off and the demand grew to the point where I couldn't do it all by myself. So then I had to bring on our first consultant. Now we're at about a team of 10 consultants, I think. So we do hundreds of plans every month. Last month we did about 370 plans in 1 month. So, you know, that kind of makes us the biggest group of providing student loan advice in the country. And it's just because we're super niche specialized in the people that have, you know, the most debt, the most complicated problems, so we can try to save them the most money.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. So listen, there are people, there are doctors who are listening to the show, even med students who look like me, first generation, they're from a minority background. And just like you said, like they are going to go into medical school. They're going to be taking a significant amount of student loan debt. But as the statistics show, whether you're Hispanic or you're African American or you're Native American, the majority of your debt or the majority of how you're going to finance these schools are going to be through student loans, which puts in a huge burden. Then you throw in the fact of glass ceilings. You throw in the fact that a lot of them may be sandwich generations. They're taking care of their kids, but they're also taking care of their parents also. So for those who are going into medical school, those who are going into or find themselves in these schools right now, what's your advice right now on how they should handle their medical school debt? And then let's talk about how they should handle it in residency, because I think there's confusion there also.
Yeah, I think like one thing that we see with like especially underrepresented minority groups is parent plus debt. So, you know, you need to take out loans for undergrad first. So the undergrad loans are capped. You can't borrow more than $57,500 max. And obviously undergrad costs a lot more than that. So what we see people do is, you know, their parents are trying to help out looking for debt because you can't get that debt in the 18-year-old's name. And so the parents will take out parent plus loans, which are unlimited. So I often see like families that have, you know, $200,000-$300,000 of loans in the parent's name, and then the child has $300,000 of loans from med school in their own name, right? And so that happens, I would say, a lot disproportionately for the communities that you mentioned. So what I would say to that is you got to be smart about the whole thing. You got to attack the whole thing in the smartest way. Kind of one thing I see among like Asian American households a little bit more disproportionately is like those household families will often like take out a mortgage against their house to give the money to their kid to pay for undergrad or maybe even med school where they can borrow less money.
Okay.
And that's a big mistake too, because that's money that could have gone, it could have been forgiven. Does that make sense?
If you're
going for public service loan forgiveness, like the worst thing you could do is not borrow the maximum, because then that whole balance would be forgiven. That's actually something that happened to my wife, who's Asian American, is, you know, her parents sort of like, you know, American dream. You could say this really for any immigrant family, right? But like, you probably have a lot of your wealth tied up in your house. And so you take out that big mortgage because the expectation is the next generation is going to support the parents, right? When and in fact, that wasn't even needed. You didn't even need that to happen. So they take out
a HELOC or whatever it is. They take out a huge amount and they use that to pay directly the school.
Direct the school, or maybe they'll cover living expenses for their child, right? Or maybe they'll cover half of the school's tuition and the kid has to take out loans for the other half. I've seen parents that will sign on to a private loan, co-sign for private loan, because they want to get a lower interest rate, right? I think the problem that there's a lack of awareness that what matters on these loans is the terms, not the interest. Everybody focuses on the interest rate. That's the wrong thing to do. You know, it's kind of like not looking at the caring about the thing that really matters. Like if you could get forgiveness on a loan, it doesn't matter what the interest rate is. It could be 100%. What matters is you can get forgiveness on it, right? So I think that what I would tell somebody that's just high school graduate, you know, any kind of like family from working class to upper middle class, like any socioeconomic range of where their family's at, I would say, you know, go to the like, first of all, what do you want to do? Like, why do you want to do it, right? Is it because you think it's like a good thing to do? I don't know. Like, if you don't know what you want to do, go to some like state school that's like highly ranked and get yourself some time to explore.
Or even community college and then transfer.
Or even community college. Yeah. Like, and just figure out what you want to do in your life if you don't have a clear idea of what you want to do. If you do have a clear idea of what you want to do, take out federal loans only. You know, if your parents have to borrow, make sure they're borrowing parent plus loans and not private loans. Right. Make sure you're taking out Stafford loans and not private loans. And then when you get to grad school,
was it the signature loans? Were those the private loans?
Those are private loans.
I remember
signature
that.
Student.
I remember hearing those a lot. Okay, so don't take out the signature loans if you don't have to from a parent perspective.
Take out the parent plus loans.
Gotcha.
You know, and then when you go to grad school, go to the best place you can go to.
Mm-hmm.
So go to the best program you can. Go to get the best highest degree of education. It's going to give you the best job you can. Because ultimately, you're going to be borrowing anyway, so you might as well get a PA or nurse practitioner or physician, you know, medical degree instead of a bachelor's degree. You know, in some cases, it's going to be the same payment.
Got you. You know, one of the things that I did, the big mistake that I made was, although my expenses were really low, there's a part of the back of the application for my financial aid where you can put blank, and I put maximum, right? Like I took out that maximum amount of student loan debt, even though looking back, I didn't need it. I didn't live in an expensive house. And I just didn't want to have to ask my parents for any money. And I just knew that I didn't have enough time to work. But I look back on those decisions and I give advice to folks right now. It's like, try to keep your expenses low when you're taking out student loans, when you're working out with your budget and you're trying to think about what you need. Try to be as realistic as possible, but also at the same time, try not to take too much out. That way you can kind of keep your student loan burden while you're in med school, you know, or in PA school as, you know, reasonable as possible. Once you graduate now, and you are working as a resident or even as a PA now, you are working, there's no residency for them. Talk to us about that. What are the first couple of decisions they should be making? You know, because I know a lot of them just wait for that booklet to come and then they start making payments. What should they do?
Consolidate when you graduate. Just consolidate and apply for pay as you earn if you owe more than your income.
Now, is consolidation and refinance the same thing, or is that two different things? Explain that.
Consolidate studentaid.gov. Just go to that website after you graduate, and then you can turn a bunch of loans into one. Makes it easy to manage, and you can also sign up for, you know, your pay as you earn income-based repayment plan at the same time. And that would be the perfect scenario if everybody did that. You know, people would probably still need student loan advice, but they probably need a lot less of it. So that's what I would recommend to somebody. If you're just a brand new graduate, go ahead and consolidate it, sign up for pay as you earn. And if you have income that's bigger than your debt because you didn't borrow that much, then sign up for revised pay as you earn because you'll get a little bit of an interest subsidy. And then, you know, once you're really secure, really feeling solid, interest has started again on student loans, you're in the private sector, private practice, that's the time to refinance, is when you're feeling pretty confident about all that.
Got it. Okay, so if you're in med school, we try not to give blanket statements, but if you're in med school, PA school, and you are finishing now, you recommend consolidating, obviously, your federal loans, your private loans, you're going to have to just handle in some form or fashion, right? You can't consolidate your private loans, correct?
You can refinance them. You can take all your private loans, refinance them into a new loan together. That's a big part of our business. We just rebate a lot of the advertising money we get to give people cashback bonuses.
Okay.
So that's one of our business models. So somebody refinances like $50,000, maybe at 7% at a private loan, maybe we can get them four and they get, you know, $300 to $500 or even $1,000 cash back when they do that too.
Understood. Okay. So consolidate is the key in training.
Federal, yeah.
Consolidate federal. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
Consolidate federal while you are in residency. And then when you are at attending level and you're making a better salary, then you recommend refinancing.
Well, or going for forgiveness, right? It's kind of, you have the fork in the road, right? Most people just need to keep it all federal until you're finishing up training. And then you have this fork in the road of, do I keep doing forgiveness or do I decide to pay this back? Because I actually have the money to do it with.
Gotcha.
So I would say probably the majority of people that book calls with us, they're booking, you know, third, fourth year of training, or, you know, if they're in fellowship, they're booking like, going into their last year of fellowship so they can get an idea of like, how do my loans, you know, interact with what job I take and, you know, what my finances are going to look like with buying a house, with like, you know, do I need extra disability insurance because of my student loans? Like, we really do cover a whole lot in an hour.
Travis, housing, interest, what's up with that, man?
It's bad.
So how are you talking to people now then? Like, what are you saying now? Because like, with inflation is going up and the interest rates are going through the roof. Like, what's up? Like, what are you saying now? What kind of advice are you giving?
We've actually gotten heavily into advertising for physician mortgages recently because I think that they make a lot of sense now because
didn't they fall out of favor like years ago and stuff?
Well, yeah, but like now you can get a better interest rate with a doctor mortgage than you can with conventional in most cases.
Gotcha.
So like one example, somebody said if you put 5% down, you could get, this is like last week, somebody said you could get 5.1, and if you do conventional 30-year, it's like 5.7. Right. And that's putting 20% down. Usually you get a higher interest rate on the physician mortgage. Usually it's like, you know, 0.25 or 0.5 higher because you're putting down such a low down payment. But just because of the nature of what's going on with like the economy, the Federal Reserve bought all these mortgage bonds and now they're trying to unload all of them. So that's pushing up mortgage rates really high because they're trying to slow down inflation. They're trying to slow down the 80 people bidding above asking price because that's obviously not sustainable. So what I tell people is if you're worried about a housing crash, you shouldn't be. Because yeah, housing might go down, but there's more inventory now. There's more room to buy with the right neighbors across from you, or you're not going to have somebody who's like spying on your every move. You know, there's more room to choose a house that's based on what you actually want versus what's available, right? So there's pros and cons. And the thing is interest rates are pretty high. If the interest rates fall because we have a recession, you'll be able to refinance again and probably lock in, you know, a lower interest rate because, you know, mortgage rates being at 5 or 6, if you can refinance down to a 3, if we have another recession, then your payment will fall a lot. So the right question to be asking is, you know, is it the right time to buy a house with my family life, with my career goals? You know, have I found a job that I'm going to be staying in for 5 to 10 years? You know, if so, buy a house and buy one that's reasonable. I tell people 2 to 2.5 times your household income. If you want to be cautious, if you want to be, you know, kind of retiring at 65, then go ahead and buy the usual 3 times your income house, right? But a lot of stuff with personal finance, you know, you just got to think about what is the context? How does that fit into your larger goals, right? If you want to be retired early at 40, don't buy a $2 million house, right?
Right.
If you love what you do, you've got good insurance in place, disability, term life, and you just think you're going to be working forever, buy the dream house. It's okay to do that. You make a good income. Your income is going to be more recession-proof than most. So don't hold back from those dreams. So it's all about kind of what are the goals, what are the dreams, focus on those, and then the stuff like student loans, just make sure it doesn't get in the way. That's kind of what we really focus on.
I love it. So listen, let's go back. Let's talk about the journey with you and your wife and how you guys were able to do it. So how much debt does she have? How long did it take her to pay it off? And what kind of plans did you use?
Well, we ended up paying hers back, but if we had only known that there was going to be a global pandemic with these special waiver programs, we could have got it all forgiven. So we ended up refinancing it. We had like a 1.9% interest rate, you know, with a variable rate. We paid it all back. But it turns out we should have kept it federal. Oops. Mm-hmm. But it's gone now.
Okay, so you've recently just paid it off, like right before the pandemic?
We paid it off in like 2017.
Okay.
So it's been about 5 years.
Gotcha. That's the same time that me and Renee paid off our loans. Mm-hmm. We went really aggressive on ours, though. We paid ours off.
Right.
But for us, it was more of it wasn't the mathematics. It was really more of the emotion. That was driving us. And we said, hey, look, like we want to get rid of our debt. Can we do it in a smart, you know, efficient way that's going to take a longer term? Or do we want to just kind of get back to what we normally want to do, which is be closer to our family, have the freedom to do X, Y, and Z, start this podcast and all these different things? Not saying that you can't doing it the other way. It's just that's what worked for us. So when we talk about in the show, I always like to give like different – there's multiple ways, guys, that you can skin this cat to make it work. And I appreciate you sharing that. So you guys consolidated your private loan or her private loans into her federal loans and then eventually by 2017, all gone.
Well, the reverse. We took her federal loans and turned them into private loans for a lower interest rate and we paid them off, right? Because we thought, you know, she made too much money. She was, you know, made about twice what she had in debt. And she had made some mistakes with managing her debt. So she didn't have as many years as we had hoped that she would have towards the forgiveness for the 10 years. So that's why we ended up doing it that way. But, you know, what would have been smarter, apparently, in benefit of hindsight, is keeping them federal. And then they would have been paused. You know, we would have paid a whole lot less that way. But it's just something that we didn't know because nobody had ever paused student loans before.
So Travis, man, we covered a lot on this episode. How is it that people can get in contact with you, with Student Loan Planner, and maybe even start a relationship with you?
Yeah, I would just go to studentloanplanner.com/help. You can see our booking page, see the details. You could just book on that page. I would just tell people to make sure that you mention Docs Outside the Box podcast. Or, you know, Nidarko, however you want to do it. But just make sure that's really clear about where you came from when you book a call, because we'll give you a year of support questions via email after the call for free, included in your call if you book with us. So but you got to mention Docs Outside the Box to get that. If you know you've got $100,000 or more, you know you've got complex loans, you know you got a lot of questions, you know, we've got like 1,500 reviews. Our average rating is like 4.97 out of 5 stars. We'll fix your problem. Just make sure you mention Docs Outside the Box when you book at studentloanplanner.com so that you get the extra bonus.
Boom. There it is. Travis with Student Loan Planner. Thank you so much for coming on Docs Outside the Box and helping us really understand the whole student loan landscape. We appreciate it. I appreciate your time, man.
Appreciate you too.
Hey guys, thanks again for listening as well as supporting Docs Outside the Box. Listen, this show is produced by Darko Media Group and the dope audio experience is edited by the one, the only Christian Parry, also known as your podcast pal. Links to him in the show notes. Listen, this is Dr. Nee. the Doc Outside the Box. I catch you on the next one. Peace.